Now we come to this extraordinary man, Akhenaten. His dates are 1377 to 1358, the dates of his reign. Akhenaten is he's a strange man. There was some kind of mysterious disease that I don't know how to define, but perhaps somebody else would know what it was. He's said to have been the first monotheist. That's wrong. I regard him as the first Protestant. He rejects the ceremonialism, the ritualism, and so forth, of the Theban priesthood, which had gained enormous wealth, by the way, as priesthoods always do. As long as they survive, gifts come to them and so forth, and it's a rich power. He rejects the priestly orders of Thebes and founds a city of his own, Amarna, in the desert. And there's the very brief period of those dates that I've just named of the Amarna time. His idea was that the deity should not be imaged, and he presents as the symbol of deity the solar disk. And instead of Amun, who is the Lord Creator of the Theban system, he calls the deity Aton, A-T-O-N, which actually is the reanimation of a much earlier notion. But it was Freud who had the suggestion in his Moses and Monotheism that Moses had been an officer in the court of Akhenaten, that it was probably one of Akhenaten's daughters who had pulled Moses out of the water in the little basket of rushes, and that with the collapse of Akhenaten's court in Amarna, because when he died, the whole thing was wiped out, then Moses, who was a believing minister in the court, had picked up a group of working people in the Delta area and left Egypt with them to continue this monotheistic cult. But the difference between Akhenaten's so-called monotheism and that of Moses is that Akhenaten saw this mystery represented in the solar disk as informing all the gods and mythologies of the whole Near East. You are the one who appears as so-and-so here, so-and-so there. Whereas the Yahvist monotheism says there is no other god in the world. And I do not inform those. They are devils. So this is a total distinction which has to be recognized if you're going to understand what's going on. This is this very handsome representation of Akhenaten in the Cairo Museum. And you see here the symbols of his lordship. Here is the good shepherd, the shepherd's crook, who guards and guides his flock. And here is the winnowing fan for thrashing wheat, separating the chaff from the seed. This is the discipline and this the protection, the two aspects of rule. The god of mercy and the god of justice. There's his beautiful queen, Nefertiti. Now, almost every woman I know who believes in reincarnation thinks she was Nefertiti at one time. I was actually in Egypt with one of those ladies, and when we were in Karnak, she looked around and said, "That's all so familiar." And here's the dear little family, Akhenaten, Nefertiti and their three beautiful daughters with their artificially deformed heads. And this is the solar disk of Aton, with its rays of blessing, each ray terminating in a hand of blessing this dear little family. We have family prayer now, and God will come to us. Here is the Tutankhamun. Now, Akhenaten had no sons, only these three lovely little daughters, and here's one of his daughters, and the young prince whom she married, who is called Tutankhamun. That is to say, as soon as Akhenaten died, the Amun priesthood took over again, and the young pharaoh was again of the Amun cult. However, we have the solar disk, which continues, and the hands of blessing. And now I come to something very interesting. The tomb of Tutankhamun is a miserable little tomb in Egyptian terms, and it's divided into two halves. And in one half was all loaded, just thrown in as though in a junk shop, all this gorgeous stuff. And the reason it was all there was that nobody seems to have thought it worth trying to rob that tomb. Right next door is the tomb of Seti I, which is about as big as any one of these buildings here. And every bit of it engraved and painted with, oh my, these tombs, you can't believe it. And the art is perfect. And they were made never to be seen. There was a kind of reality there. I mean, there's a concretization you get in the Egyptian thing. A kind of reality there that endured. And the souls, one aspect of the soul, the Ba, remained in that tomb. Well, Akhenaten's tomb itself, his coffin and so forth, itself in that tomb, had a very interesting symbolic form. There were three rectangular boxes, one inside the other, in the way of a Chinese box, gold-plated and so forth, with these lovely guardian spirits watching them. And then within the boxes would be a great stone coffin sort of thing, and within that, two sarcophagi. One of them, the outer one, of precious wood, inlaid with gold and lapis lazuli, in the form of the young pharaoh, and then within that, a coffin of solid gold. Again, in the form of the pharaoh. This gorgeous thing, that's solid gold. And in those days, this meant the lives of hundreds and hundreds of people who'd been mining the gold. Now, when I saw that, and I've noticed many, many parallels between Egyptian symbology and the mystical philosophy of India, something occurred to me, and I'm just going to offer it as a suggestion, that these three boxes and the two sarcophagi inside the stone coffin represent what in India are called the five sheaths. S-H-E-A-T-H-S, the five sheaths that enclose the Atman, enclose the self, the transcendent mystery. Since I'm going to be talking about Hinduism a little bit, it'd be worth speaking of these five sheaths. The first sheath is called the sheath of food, anamaya kosha. That's what our body is made of. It's made of food, and when you die, it becomes food for the worms, the vultures, the jackals, or the fire. The second sheath is pranamaya kosha, that is the breath, the sheath of breath, which ignites the food, oxidation, burns, gives heat, temperature, and life. The third sheath is manomaya kosha, the mental sheath. Now, this mentality is in touch with the food sheath. And when the food sheath is in pain, it feels pain and thinks, oh, all is sorrowful. And when the food sheath is happy, it's happy too. The mental sheath is oriented to the food and breath sheaths. This is what I think is represented in the three rectangular boxes. Then we have a long gap. And I think this may be what is represented by the stone coffin, or maybe not. Maybe the stone coffin represented the next sheath, but I think more likely the wooden sarcophagus did. The next sheath is known as Vijnanamaya Kosha, the sheath of wisdom. This is the wisdom of the body, the wisdom that shaped you in the mother womb. The wisdom that knew the moment you were born how to nurse. The wisdom that brings up the grass and informs the trees and the mountains and the universe. The wisdom of the body. That spontaneous thing on which the mentality rides and which the mentality has to know about. We've had breakfast. Our body is digesting that breakfast. I dare say there isn't a soul in this room who would know mentally what the chemistry of the breakfast requirements were for digestion this morning. And yet you're doing it. Who else? And that's your wisdom body. And then what do you think? Beneath the wisdom body, Anandamaya Kosha, the sheath of bliss. Life is a manifestation of rapture. And this poor mental sheath up here gets all tied up with what's happening to the food body. And it thinks, oh dear, oh dear. All life is sorrowful. Suppose every 2 weeks on a lawn, somebody goes over the lawn with a lawnmower. Suppose the grass were to think, well, what's the use? These are the two completely different orientations. And the mental sheath has to do with ethics, good and evil, light and darkness, pain and pleasure. The wisdom sheath knows that there's something before that, and it's rapture. So that's what you are, really. You're rooted in rapture. And even in your pain, in your great anguish, in your sorrow, if you know where the rapture door is, you can realize that this is life's rapture. And where the pain is, there's the life. This is the kind of stuff that we have in these heroic mythologies. Now we come to Ramses II. If Moses was, as Freud suggests, a member of the court of Akhenaten, then the Exodus must have taken place around 1358. This is the death of Akhenaten. That's the earliest date anybody's ever proposed for the Exodus. In the book of Exodus, the Pharaoh, who is impugned there, is probably, it seems to be, Ramses II. Ramses' dates are about 1305 to 1234 or 36. He reigned for a long, long season. He was enormously powerful. And I don't think any scholar would suggest that he could possibly have been the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Furthermore, he wasn't drowned in the Red Sea. He was entombed right here. This is the great pair of tombs of Ramses II and his favorite wife, who was one of his daughters. In Caesar and Cleopatra of Bernard Shaw, when Caesar meets Cleopatra, he has among his officers a British officer. And when he learns from Cleopatra that she was born from an incest marriage, the British officer expresses great shock. And Caesar says to Cleopatra, "Don't mind him, he's British. He thinks the laws of his tribe are the laws of the universe." This great tomb now, with the ridiculous Aswan Dam that has lifted the waters up to here, has been elevated and placed up here by a miracle of modern engineering. The horrible thing about that dam, this Lake Nasser backed up and wiped out the whole province of Nubia. And where are the Nubians? They are packed into miserable housing developments nearby. When I saw that, I thought of Goethe's Faust, Part 2, Act 5. Faust has won the world war, and he's now going to make the world great. And what is he doing? He is draining swamps and building housing developments. But in making his conquest, and in order to build the housing development, he has to displace people who were there in the first place. And the little scene of Baucis and Philemon, the lovely little couple who were living in their ancestral place, a little old couple, displaced by a couple of rough thugs, they die. And this is it for the whole province of Nubia. And of course, Mephistopheles says when he sees the dam going up, "I look forward to the day when it bursts." And he says also of Faust, who has been moving on, all the glory of life wasn't enough to satisfy his desire for more. He ends up building housing developments and foresees a whole world of housing developments. And he says, "To that wonderful social arrangement, I could say yea." And then he dies. And Mephistopheles says, "All the glories of life, and the last, stupidest, dullest thing of all, to this he says yea." So now let's go in to this fantastic tomb, carved, and you know, not with any machines, but with little pickaxes into the mountain. The date would be that of the death of the pharaoh, Ramses II, about 1234 or 1236, somewhere in there. And when you get up at a distance, the form is perfect. This is something to consider. Now we go in, and here is a representation of Ramses with the shepherd's crook and the winnowing fan. This is a standard motif in Egyptian art of the conquering pharaoh. You can't see it because of the pillar here, but the enemy is there on his knees. The pharaoh has his top knot. He's about to slam him dead. These are conquering people. After the Hyksos invasion, which took place when the Asians came into Egypt around 1750 BC and were then driven out, the Egyptians became imperialists. They moved up into Asia Minor and right into what's now Palestine and so forth, and then up the coast as far as to what is now Turkey, where the Hittites had come in, the children of Het, and there they were stopped. And so you have the great Egyptian empire as a reply to the invasion that had taken place, and the pharaohs are great warriors. This is an important room. Here is Horus, here is Ramses himself, here is Amun, and here is the god Ptah, a lunar deity. So Ramses is himself among the highest deities now. And now with respect to the Exodus again. During the time of Akhenaten, who wasn't paying much attention to the empire, letters were coming, written in Babylonian, to the court at Amarna. They're known as the Amarna letters. And they were from the governors of the various provinces in Asia. They were complaining that their provinces were being invaded by Bedouins from the desert, who were sometimes called Habiru. And it is suggested this is certainly the first appearance of the word in writing, and that these were tribes of the kind that then are associated with the Mosaic history. So that there were invasions taking place at the time of Akhenaten. The Exodus, as I say, is generally associated in the biblical tradition with the time of Ramses, which is very much later, 1234. But nobody can possibly believe that anything like that happened at the time of Ramses. There's another pharaoh, Merneptah, who follows, and from the dates around 1234 to 1220, he was a weak pharaoh, actually physically ill, and died very young. This may, if there was anything like the Exodus, this may have been the pharaoh of the Exodus. Now we come to this musing problem of crossing the waters of the Red Sea. Now, is this to be interpreted as a mythological event, as a spiritual symbol of some kind, or is it a fact? And I have so many friends that are saying, well, yes, they crossed in a shallow place and the wind was blowing in just the right direction, and so they got across. But then read on a few more chapters in the book, and we come to the Jordan, and we're going to cross the Jordan. And the waters of the Jordan pile up like walls on either side, and the tribe walks between. This is a mythological motif you'll find everywhere. The crossing of the waters. It's comparable to the Symplegades, the rocks that clash together. The pair of opposites have withdrawn and we've gone through the middle. What came into Egypt? The patriarchs. Joseph through the well was the first. Mythological again. It was a dry well, but it was a well just the same. And so we come in through water, and we go out through water. When you have this in and out in a mythology, try to see what came in and what went out, and then you'll find what the mystical value is. What came in were the patriarchs, what went out were the people. That is the great thing that coalesced and came to knowledge of itself in Egypt, in the land of mud, in the land of suffering, in the abyss. And Moses was not the hero. The hero of the Old Testament is the people. And they are conceived of as a unit. and one is a member of that people, or one is out. And this accent on the group, membership in the group, is entirely Near Eastern. In Europe, you get another accent. One of the problems in the European assimilation of Christianity was recovering and maintaining then the sense of the individual as a unique entity. And the translation of this group tradition into a tradition of individual realization. This is the problem of the Grail tradition in the 13th century of Europe. This is when it was pulled together in a new way. But this struck me when I was teaching at Sarah Lawrence College, where I think more than half of my students were Jewish girls. One young woman who had been one of the really most remarkable members of the class that year, in her last conference, she said to me, "You know, Mr. Campbell, if I didn't think of myself as Jewish, I wouldn't know my identity." I was stunned. I said, "Rachel, what are you saying? I've never thought of you either as Jewish or anything else but as Rachel. And suppose I were to say to you, if I didn't think of myself as Irish, I wouldn't know my identity." I said, "That wouldn't make sense, would it?" These are two totally different ways of relating to race. One in the way, "Oh yes, that's what I am, and all my peculiarities come from that misfortune." And the other is, "No, this is my being." This is important to realize about the Jewish tradition. It has its roots here in the idea of a people. Now again, with Martin Buber, the next meeting, he was talking about the Phoenicians and what terrible criminals they were in sacrificing their oldest sons to Moloch. Then about 15 minutes later, he's come to Abraham about to sacrifice Isaac. "Well, so you can't let a thing like that go by." And I said, "Dr. Buber," so he looked at me a little more cautiously than the first time, and I said, "How do you distinguish between a divine and a diabolical invitation?" He says, "What do you mean by that?" I said, "Well, only 15 minutes ago, you were excoriating the Phoenicians for killing their oldest sons, and now you're celebrating Abraham above all human life for having been about to do the same thing with his oldest son." So what's the answer? The answer is we, that's the capital W, we believe that God spoke to Abraham. That's all I got from that man. So things that are done by us are different from things that are done by others, and that's another characteristic of this whole tradition that we're talking about. Moses now is not the hero. The tribe is the hero. This is a tribal mythology, and with the only God of the universe is theirs. This is very important. Now what about the plagues and all that kind of thing? What kind of deity is that? He sends these plagues for the fun of it. Hardens Pharaoh's heart so that he won't let the people go so he can send another plague. Well, this is what it says in the book. It's a good thing to read, you know. And now I come to another matter. Just at the time of Akhenaten, that's 1377 to 1358 or so, the Indo-Europeans are invading India. And this is the beginning of a total transformation of the Indian consciousness. They're nomads. And from here on, I want to discuss the emergence of the philosophies and ritual cults of India, and we'll move on then to more recent matters.
In Egyptian mythology, much is made of the symbolism of the sun and the moon. Campbell concludes by asserting that although we may no longer be aware of their influence, these symbolic forms still have power in our lives today.
Now, related to this, we have in Germany the male moon and female sun, der Mond, die Sonne. And in France, the male sun and female moon, la lune and le soleil. Hence, world wars every now and then. These are two totally different psychologies. And they are. La clarté française, anything that can't be rationally interpreted, we don't talk about in French. But the German mystic mood is right there. It's a fascinating thing to see. Now, in Egypt, the first four dynasties were moon dynasties, with the pharaoh identified with Osiris, Osiris being there the high god. With the fifth dynasty, which comes in around 2500 BC, we have a solar mythology coming in, the god Re. And now a very interesting thing. For a couple of decades, Osiris was regarded as a demon and was rejected. But then the Osiris mythology and the Re mythology became united, and it became united in the following way. Osiris is the dead and resurrected god. He is the son now of Re, who is the eternal Lord of Light. And Osiris's own eldest son, Horus, becomes the solar disk that crosses the sky. But he is the one who resurrects Osiris and is, as it were, the paraclete. Do you see what we have here? We have Father, Son, and Holy Ghost of the Christian myth. The Father, Re, the Son, Osiris, and the paraclete, Horus. And this Christian mythology was put together in Alexandria, among other places, while the mythology of Osiris was still intact.